From New York City, this is Mark to Markets. I'm your host, Mark Penziner. On this podcast, we discuss topics near and far from personal finance. Any questions or comments, I can be reached at mark.penziner@bernstein.com or call me directly at 212-969-6655. Over the last few months on this podcast, we've been focused very much on very specific capital markets topics, inflation, the outlook for bonds, where stocks are today. But as you know, I like to expand the reach of this podcast from things to restaurants and food and sports. And today I thought it would be a really interesting time to open up the podcast to the art world. And to do that, I've invited in two experts in the space, Hildy Lynn Heffelstein and Matthew Capasso. And guys, I'm going to let you introduce yourselves to give our listeners a background of who you are and what you're up to.
Good. So I'm Matthew Capasso. I started my career off in the investment space and found my way into the art market, first through Christie's and now with a technology company in the art space. And I could say I'm an art market analyst. I track trends. I write about it. I speak about it online. And I'm thrilled to be here.
Hildy, let's get our audience up to speed on all the things you're doing.
Sure. My name is Hildy Lynn Heffelstein, and I'm known on Instagram as @JerryGagosian. I professionally study the art world and the art market, and then I satirize it. And I've accumulated 101,000 dedicated followers on my Instagram to create a very tight-knit community of both artists, collectors, curators, and art world insiders who have very in-depth conversations via my network about exactly what is going on. I publish a art world newsletter about once a month from my website, larrysaltz.com, which is a bit of like an insider baseball that helps people sort of break down this bull market of an art world and help people sort of understand exactly what's going on and help them decide what path they want to take should they enter the game of art.
From your both of your perspectives, what's the big story in the art world today?
The biggest story right now in the art world is that for a long time, art collecting has been an analog game, right? So you become interested, and for all intents and purposes, art objects have fully become a derivative of finance. They are incredible and very unique assets and are IRL in real life NFTs, non-fungible tokens, right? But for a long time, it's been an analog game. So you have to go to the art shows, you have to meet the dealers in person, you have to sort of work your way up to get gaining primary access to the market, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, slowly tech has been encroaching, and this notion of the NFT, which is not new, mind you. NFTs have been around for several years, but it wasn't until about 2-3 years ago, the Winklevoss twins launched the first big NFT platform, Nifty Gateway, that it started to become taken seriously as they started inviting artists to actually utilize the platform. And then all of a sudden, these communities that have been online started growing and pushing forward their digital art. And so the big story right now in the art world is sort of this power struggle between the analog, the traditional art world, and this burgeoning new NFT market, which is the online tech crypto version of the same game, essentially.
For some of the listeners, they're going to be familiar with the letters NFT, but they're not going to really know what that is or how it plays in the art space. So can Can you guys, in as simple English as possible, just explain to the listeners what's an NFT and how does it play in the art space?
An NFT, a non-fungible token, is a way to encapsulate or create a space that is unique on the blockchain to denote a digital asset. And a digital asset in the art sense would be a digital artwork. So when people are buying unique, non-fungible, which means, you know, it can't be exchanged for something else. It is what it is. It's unique to unto itself on the blockchain. It's a token, or almost like a letter of authenticity, you could think of it, for this digital asset. And then these digital assets, these tokens can live in something like a MetaMask wallet or a place where you house them, and they are proof that you are owner of these unique digital assets.
So the old world was, I own a piece of art. I can touch it. I can look at it. I can walk into a room and I can see it, right? It's three dimensional. It's real. It, the Mona Lisa is in the Louvre, period, end of story, right? The NFT art, to my understanding, is it's digital, right? I mean, for those who aren't in this space, it's in the cloud, it's on a hard drive. I mean, I know that's not literally how it works. There's one of them. And if you have this file, if you want to think of it, it is the original file. You're the only person who has the file. You carry it around with you. I don't know if it's able to be projected or shown or put on a screen, but you're the exclusive owner of this file that contains art, right? So it's an authenticated piece of art that you don't have to touch like you would the Mona Lisa. Is that a very layman's way to think about it?
I think how I always perceive NFTs are, it's a tool and a method by which you ascribe ownership to these digital assets, right? We're using the term NFT as a catch-all to describe any sort of image that's in zeros and ones online, but the real key thing is the ownership. And that's where the NFT, and Hilly alluded to, the blockchain is a way to solidify that, hey, I, Matthew Capasso, purchased this. It is written into the blockchain and I receive the non-fungible token rights there. And then those non-fungible token rights will then transfer upon a sale in a secondary context. And that non-fungible token will be transferred. That transaction will be recorded on the blockchain and forever known that I own the original and now this other individual now owns it.
Yeah. So I feel like the art world is kind of having a bifurcated conversation. And tell me if I'm wrong. There's this, I don't want to call it old world, maybe traditional world of art galleries and auction houses and physical pieces of art, whether they're old world masters or modern pieces, right? And there were barriers to entry and a traditional way of doing things. And it seems like parallel to that, there's this technology, art, young money, crypto space emerging too. Is that a fair commentary? And are those worlds overlapping? Are they not? Is that something that you're seeing and dealing with every day?
Yes. So there definitely is a bifurcated conversation. I actually just put out in my most recent newsletter, you know, the war rages strong between the art bros and the crypto bros. And right now there actually really is sort of this fight for dominance about who's right in this. Make no mistake, you know, the art world, because of its non-transparency and its barriers to entry for ages of old, have fallen very out of fashion with young people who have disposable income and who would like to begin sort of playing the art game. However, the analog art game, the traditional art game, takes time. And there are rules to that game that one must abide if you want to actually begin purchasing works that have any significant value. And as I mentioned, that requires developing relationships with dealers, learning about the artist. There's oftentimes scholarship that goes into, you know, learning and understanding the discourse of contemporary art. That takes time. This new Wild Wild West NFT world, it's happened so fast. There's zero scholarship put behind this. And there's a lot of faux market creation and inflation that is happening in this world before our very eyes that should give one pause before, you know, pouring your life's savings and all of your assets into, because, you know, we're not sure exactly which way this is going to go. This isn't to undercut the technology of blockchain technology, nor is it to undercut this vehicle of NFT. But, you know, you can go on Twitter, you can go on TikTok, and people will in real time be explaining to you how they're creating these markets out of thin air and how you too can join it. And I saw a meme on Instagram yesterday, which explained it very well. They said, somebody the other day explained to me that NFTs are like Mary Kay for young men. And there is, to a certain extent, some scheming, some hustling, and perhaps some pyramid scheming that is happening. The good thing is that at certain levels, auction houses and some major art dealers are coming in and working with specific artists to mint NFTs. And these would probably be your safer bets in terms of understanding that these are sort of being authenticated through the eyes of the traditional art world. Again, this is not a hierarchy. I'm not putting a hierarchy on it. I'm just watching. You know, we were just down in Miami, and literally there's trucks pulling trailers that say like "Crypto Kitty, get in on it now," blasting, you know, trance house music, and every event was NFT this, NFT that, get in, make lots of money, and it can be a little scary.
Go ahead, Matt.
No, I was going to add to that and start with a story. And if your listeners are familiar with the auction houses, when we talk about them, we're really talking about Christie's, Sotheby's, and Phillips as the major three auction house players across the world. In November of this year, Christie's and all the auction houses held their big evening sale moments. This is where the most high value, high profile works are sold. It's what the New York Times will report out the next morning about the price achieved for a certain object. And Hildy and I went and visited the Christie's View, which is an exhibition they run of the works that are going to be sold in these evening sales. And there's Van Goghs and Monets and Basquiats in these hallways. But in the corner of the large Christie's gallery space was a very small room with a rotating sculpture of a moon man walking and traversing some sort of space terrain, a digital rendering. And it was by an artist called Beeple, who's very well known in the NFT community. And in that room, I think there was maybe 25 to 30 people. The average age was around 18 to 20 years old. I worked at Christie's for a long time. And by the way, those kids in there did not care about the Van Goghs and the Basquiats and the other rooms. They were there to see Beeple. And the interesting thing for me is I realized these parallel worlds that are happening, traditional capital A fine art market, and this new space in NFT are converging at certain points in institutions like Christie's. And you're seeing companies, Christie's, Sotheby's, and Phillips, engage in the NFT space full-heartedly. So they're creating NFT platforms that interested people can go and buy an NFT. And this is a new trend. I think the auction houses are recognizing that there's a market taking place and a demand needed to be filled. And these historic auction houses that are each over 300 years old understand that when they ascribe their brand to something, they're validating it in a marketplace and giving it some gravity. And there's been a lot of successful sales that the auction houses have done, and it's created a new revenue model for the auction houses. And it's opened up a broader set of collectors into the space.
Let me ask a question about the traditional art market. All asset classes are up the last few years, right? That's the world I sit in, finance. How's the art market done of late? Hilde, you mentioned the bull market.
I'll just say, Mark, the art market is firing on almost all cylinders across the board. So just to take it back to this November evening sale auction season at the auction houses, unbelievable achievements in prices at auction across all of the houses. I think Christie's held a sale of 50 works where 100% of them sold. That barely rarely happens where an entire sale will sell through. Sotheby's was fortunate enough to win the collection of the Macklowe family. And this made a lot of news, a contentious divorce and a settlement needed to be. Unbelievable achievement. I think somewhere like $700 million in hammer prices. That's at the high end of the market. Those are the big blue chip names that you hear about in art history textbooks. We just got back from Miami Basel. That's where primary market galleries, small, big, medium, from around the world are selling new works onto the market from mostly living young artists. And talking to those gallerists, the results were exceptional. Every work is selling. And it seems like the market is now just, as I said, firing on all cylinders. There's clearly interest in the Asian market coming in into contemporary art. I was reflecting on what we're seeing in the US economy. There could be a little bit of this inflation tax concerns that some collectors are having and how placing capital into fine art might be a safe place. There was probably a handful of collectors that over the past couple years of this pandemic were well insulated from some of the economic downturns and their asset prices has rose. They're feeling good. They spent months or a year at home looking at their walls and realizing, hey, I could do something with this. And I think they're feeling good. And I also think on the seller and the demands and the sell side, supply side, that suppliers are looking at a market and feeling very optimistic and feeling like it's time to sell. So you're seeing a robust demand and increasing supply and the market's matching. And this is why you're seeing extraordinary prices across the entire art market.
So you basically asked the question I was going to ask you. When prices are so high, in my world, right, if stocks are high, people want to buy because they want to get in on the mania, but typically it's a good time to be a seller when prices are high. So you guys represent artists, you represent sellers, curators, buyers. How are you advising people today to think about the market?
Well, I'll just go back and say that, you know, the art market is one of the markets that during the pandemic did better than worse, because they had all of their overhead essentially evaporated because in-person viewing went away. So essentially, people were just buying off of PDFs and what they saw in online viewing rooms, which, you know, the tech for that ended up being much cheaper than paying, you know, premium New York real estate prices to have a gallery put somewhere. It also began, you know, this trend began of what I'm sort of seeing. Traditionally in the past, the way that you get into the art world is a curator discovers your work, right? And you get a chance to have an exhibition because the curator finds your work to be very important or relevant to our time, et cetera, et cetera. The curators of our time, though, now seem to be these investors, speculators, and flippers on the art market, because what they're doing is they're going around, they're bypassing the gallery system, they're finding young emerging talent, and they're investing in it very early, and then they're buying up all that they can find, and then selling that on the secondary market, and sort of helping create these markets for these young artists with or without galleries. And so this is sort of a completely, a few years ago, this would have been extremely frowned upon in the art world. And instead of the art world shutting that down, which would have been the traditional way, and ignoring those artists, because these markets have been now created and have become so financially valuable, the galleries themselves are acquiescing to these new markets for these new artists. And when I say the market is roaring, the appetite is insatiable, which I think actually feeds into the NFT idea. To a certain extent, there's not enough for people to buy right now. People are so excited about the opportunity to buy art and see these incredible returns on emerging contemporary art. For example, again, not to keep giving these auction houses an advertisement, but they're doing these contemporary art now or ultra contemporary art sales, which are something that you didn't see in the past. Before, you were seeing old masters or post-war or impressionism being sold at these auction houses. But now they're skipping and they're going straight to these ultra contemporary, what I refer to often in my on my Instagram page as well as in my newsletter, as wet paintings. Or paintings that have the nose of linseed oil, literally meaning they were just painted this year, last year, and they're already going to auction. And people are seeing like 1300% returns on paintings that they bought for, you know, $12,000 that are selling for $1.4 million. You know, I know collectors, for example, who will go around and they'll buy, instead of buying an $850,000 classic work of art, they'll go around and they can buy 40 of those. And out of the 40 of those, the likelihood that they're gonna, at this moment with the market the way it is, see an incredible return on at least five of those works is very, very high right now.
It's the venture capital model. You can really think of it in that.
You bring venture capital. I think that's right from a model perspective. The thing that was going through my head was a bit of the Robin Hood model, or not model, but too much new money chasing really speculative returns.
Absolutely.
And I guess the question in the art world, like it would be in the stock world, is, when you have a stock that's trading at, you know, a billion times earnings, because there are no earnings, you have to ask the question, is that company any good, right? And I guess the question in the art market is, when a painting's being sold at for $10,000 and a year later it's going for $1.4 million, how do you know? And Hilde, you brought up a point, you know, scholarly learning over time about art and what has meaning and what's good, for simple terms. How do you know in this new paradigm, what's any good? What has staying power? Is there a way to know?
I really advise people to make sure you love the work, because if you don't actually love the thing that you're buying, there's a chance you're going to end up with something worthless that you don't like. So make sure you actually like the work that you're buying. The other thing is, when you're doing your research about how to buy a work of art, or if you're working with an art advisor, if somebody wants to work with me or with Matthew on something like this, you know, a way to really figure out if something is good is to look at the trajectory of art history and sort of understand, where does this artist fit in all of this? And a lot of times, this is where galleries play an important role because they do a lot of this legwork to help the scholarship come into place and to also give these artists visibility next to their sort of intellectual ancestors so that you understand that this doesn't just appear out of a vacuum. In fact, this work is in direct lineage with this very long, you know, 2,000 year conversation, basically since the dawn of civilization, that art has been having with itself, because art is mimetic. It's like music, right? You listen to music, and music has a lineage, it has a heritage, and so does art, and contemporary art is also a part of that. So when you're looking for something good, you want to look for something that is directly in conversation and is adding to the cacophony of this sort of human song that we're singing.
When we talk about the art market, we're oftentimes thinking of it as this blob that you invest in, but really the art market is this series of smaller individual markets that can behave very differently. We've talked a lot about contemporary art in this conversation. Contemporary art basically works that are created by living artists today. And a lot of artists that were creating works in the late 20th century. You can roll back, people use the phrase modern art. And sometimes it's conflated with contemporary art. Modern art is typically in the periods between 1870s up into the mid 20th century of mostly artists that are no longer living and really were the avant-garde of pushing forward just really creative movements. These are the surrealisms you hear about, or cubism, abstract expressionism. And then you go back further and people use a phrase called old masters, which is really paintings from Renaissance up until the 18th century, maybe a little bit past then. And look, the scholars debate where the lines end and begin, but really the markets will behave differently. A work of a contemporary artist today, firstly, has a massive, massive secondary market and it's very robust. Also, the price points on the primary market tend to be very low, and the potential upsides are unknown or potentially massive. So you're seeing an investment community that's looking at those as a potential high risk, high return play. Works of masterpieces of the modern art movements tend to have really high prices now, are only available on the secondary market. So you have to buy them in auction houses or private secondary dealers. The returns can be great, but a lot of times the market is so mature that the financial gains you can get from these assets are just generally in the aggregate lower than a very contemporary painter. And that trend continues down to the old master space. Again, there's always exceptions and there's phenomenal works of art that appear at that incredible dealer, you get a price, they sell very high in the secondary. But old masters is also a very mature market. So the financial returns for those investments are relatively low. Now, I will say there's a potential now as people's eyes focus on contemporary art, you're actually seeing this X of earnings price points. You know, we talk about like Flyer Tech stocks, for example, you know, the earnings ratios, the price to earnings ratios are massive. You could potentially see some interesting bargains at those lower ends of the old masters and the modern art movements, right? Because the eyeballs and the markets are just not there, but there is incredible works there to be collected. And the art market does change and tastes do change and things will come back. So it's just an interesting way to think about it. It's like rotating into different sectors in the equity markets, right? You think like fast growing high tech stocks in the contemporary space. You can think of old masters and sort of like this industrials, or my father used to work in telecom, or these kind of slow moving older industries. And modern art sits somewhere in the middle. So there's a different risk profile and a different return profile investing in all of these kinds of assets. One interesting company that I'll plug is, and this is a movement we're seeing, and a couple of companies are trying to do this, is the fractionalized ownership of artworks.
Interesting.
So there's a couple companies doing this in the space where they'll go out, use their own capital, their investor capital, to acquire big works of art. They'll file with the SEC to securitize individualized shares. It's an IPO, effectively. And they'll issue X amount of shares, and then they'll sell tranches of that to either individuals or institutions such as a hedge fund, investment funds, family offices, et cetera. Gaining those investors exposure to this one single artwork's price movements without those individuals, investors having to own the artwork, insure it, transport it, store it, all of those types of things. So they're getting the financial exposure without assuming the entire risk of owning the asset.
Hildy, Matt, this was super informative. It feels like we're having this conversation at a point in time where things are rapidly changing in a highly appreciating industry. And it feels like if we have this conversation 12 months from now, it could be entirely different, which makes it probably an incredibly exciting time for you guys.
Yes. And if we would have had this conversation 6 months ago, it would have been completely different. And if we would have had it 1 year ago, it would have been completely different. We, in the art world, after 2008, we have always been weary of this bubble bursting. And but I did have a conversation with somebody very recently after somebody very high up at an auction house after some incredible results were gained. And I said, or I asked him, I said, what does this mean? Is this proof that we're just, you know, the airplane, everybody's seated for takeoff, flight attendants are seated for takeoff, you know, and we're just running, we're barreling down the runway. And is this just the beginning of takeoff for a market now that, I mean, in some instances, like where can it end? Does it end? Especially now that it's becoming digitized, or is this the like put on your breathing mask, like we're at the beginning of a different kind of an end? And right now that is truly something to watch and see. So, you know, for any of your listeners who are interested in collecting art, it's an amazing, very fulfilling, gratifying thing to do. It's a wonderful way to support human beings who have something to say about the times within which we live or the time within which they lived. It's a great way to be philanthropic. There's so many wonderful reasons to collect art. And I'm not saying that the financial aspect should be ignored, but it should not be the primary reason that you get into art. I invite our, you know, clients that I work with to really fall in love with this, because there are so many voices out there that have been underrepresented for a long time. There's so many people who make incredible objects that are meant to be seen. And it is through the patronage and stewardship of good art collectors who do their homework that will, you know, make these works possible to be seen for the future. And that really is what we're doing. Money will insulate these objects so that in the future, people can see like what we were thinking about and what we were talking about in the times that we lived. And you know, art is this incredible vessel that time travels and will be a gift. What's being made now will be a gift to the future, and what we have from the past is a gift from the past.
I think that's a perfect bow for this conversation. Matt, Hildy, thanks so much for your time.
Of course.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, feel free to email me at mark.pensner@bernstein.com or call me at 212-969-6655 for any questions on this or any other related topic. And make sure to like or review us and this podcast wherever you find it. Happy holidays. Until next time.